Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan, and you're listening at CindySheehanSoapbox.com. Well, today we have a very full show. We have two Soapbox listeners, journalists, who are going to call in with special reports. Our first special report will be from James Rhodes in Vietnam, where he's interviewing an American expat. And our second report will be from journalism teacher and journalist Lisa Barr. And Lisa will be covering the October protests in D.C. for Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. Right now, as we're taping this is the so-called International Peace Day. It was instituted by the U.N. in 2002. And now the U.S., which really, come on, the U.S. is the sponsor of and benefactor of the U.N. when the U.N. legitimizes its crimes. But anyway, the U.S. was only bombing one country in 2002 when the International Peace Day was instituted. Now we're bombing at least six, and we have a Nobel Peace Prize winner as the emperor of this military junta that is the United States. And also this, our first half-African president is bombing a country in Africa, Libya, and there's just so much happening with the new AFRICOM and bases being built all over and the support of warlords in Somalia. So when we come back from this quick break, we'll be listening to James Rhodes from Vietnam.
We can only keep this radio show on the air with your support. The Soapbox is not sponsored by corporate dollars or owned by any station, which means we need your contributions to keep Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox alive. Being on the air is a chance to break through with an alternative, progressive viewpoint, going out to many listeners, people that can be affected and inspired to create change. Join the list of Soapbox supporters. Visit CindySheehanSoapbox.com. And click on the donate link there, or send a check or money order to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox, Post Office Box 6264, Vacaville, California, 95696. Please make a contribution today of any amount to ensure that the Soapbox is here to stay. Help keep Cindy on the air.
This is Jim Rhodes reporting exclusively for Cindy Sheehan Soapbox in California. Today we're in downtown Hanoi. I mean the old quarter, the place that's over 1,000 years old. And we're talking to a displaced Californian, my friend Rick Peltier, who worked for many years in California as a licensed building contractor, but had the foresight to get out before the bottom fell out. And Rick, I understand that although you were not in the war in Vietnam, you felt drawn to come here. Can you explain to our viewers how this happened?
Well, I guess there's many reasons. Probably one primary reason, I knew a number of friends who were unfortunate and were drafted and had to come here as unwilling soldiers at that time. And when they returned, many of them commented how beautiful the country was and how beautiful the people were, and they thought it was a damn shame that there was such a war going on there at that time. So that was one reason. I had no fear of coming here because of the people. And then wanting to go to Asia, I was talking with other friends and several who had actually traveled here recently as tourists. Had told me what a beautiful place Vietnam is and how safe it was to travel there. So that, and also just feeling drawn there from some mysterious force, I decided to come anyway.
Well, that's very interesting. When you say you felt drawn here, I've heard that numerous times, but basically it's been from people like myself who served in combat here that we seem to have a compelling need to come back. But as you were not part of the military presence here, can you explain more about what you felt that was drawing you specifically to come to Vietnam?
Well, Jim, I mean, sometimes there's no one real reason. You know, when I was searching on the internet where I would like to go and try to live for an extended period, Vietnam just kept popping up. And I thought it was ironic at the time because of all the anxiety many of us felt back in the 60s about being drafted and basically having to go fight in a war we didn't support or agree with or thought was even worthwhile being involved in. So, you know, facing issues that touch on deep fear. Now, obviously, 40 years later, I knew that Vietnam was a safe place. No one was shooting at each other anymore. But I guess I wanted to see how the country has fared since then. And again, never having been in Asia, just curious about Asian culture in general. And so, you know, with this calling and having heard from people who were here as soldiers and then more recently people who were here as tourists, I felt it was a worthwhile place to at the least come and visit as a tourist and, if possible, stay and live and work.
Oh, outstanding. And you know, Rick, I have heard that from so many other expats who've come here, both veterans and in particular non-veterans alike. You can speak to the fact that you used to have a really good job in California, and as you jokingly say, you are willingly homeless now, but your experience in Vietnam, both working and living, has been very positive for you, has it not?
Oh, yeah. It's actually exceeded any expectations or fantasies I may have had before I came. I have always felt welcome. I have felt safer in here, especially in the big cities, than in just about any American city where I have ever lived. So that actually means a lot, to not to worry about somebody coming and sticking a gun in your face or a knife in your back. It's important, you know, to be in a society that is safe. And also, like I mentioned before, I found firsthand the people are very welcoming, very friendly. And maybe the most important thing is almost zero animosity or hostility towards me as an American who clearly looks like I'm old enough to have been a soldier here. I have never experienced any negativity in regards to that. In fact, just the opposite. I've experienced a lot of interest in the fact that I'm American, what life is like in America, and I have always felt very welcome here.
Rick, during your stay here, I know you've run into various victims of herbicidal poisons and unexploded ordnance, and that has touched you rather deeply. Can you tell our listening audience your feelings regarding Agent Orange victims in Vietnam, as well as people who've been victimized by ordnance left behind by the United States military?
Well, you know, I think like many Americans before I came here, I just figured, oh, that's 40 years ago, it's all over, it's in the past. But what I very quickly came to learn is it is an ongoing legacy of the war. There are still many unexploded ordnance, one of the worst being bomblets from cluster bombs that were dropped that have not exploded. They're about the size of a baseball. Many kids will go out and find one of these 30-year-old rusted things out in the forest, pick it up, and now lose a hand. And then, of course, the victims of Agent Orange, you know, I know for me, it's just something that is not really, most Americans aren't aware of. And that is one of the legacies of any war, that especially modern warfare, when we're throwing around poisons and bombs, people suffer for many, many, many years after that. And in Vietnam, people are continuing to suffer from that.
And Rick, what do you think of the United States government's position that, quote, and I know this very well, there is no conclusive link between herbicidal poisons and any medical condition anyone is suffering from here, unquote, because that line has been used against we veterans who've been exposed to as well. And additionally, I would like to point out to the American listening audience, There is some misconception about this alleged huge Agent Orange settlement we received. There was a settlement. The chemical company paid millions of dollars. And what is not known is that the average American exposed to Agent Orange received $89. That was the average payment. The rest went to attorneys. Big surprise. So could you comment on your feeling about the U.S. government position that, hey, you can't prove it, so you can't hold us responsible, not only for the Vietnamese, but for the American veterans as well?
Well, Jim, you know, before I met you, I guess, like most Americans, I was ignorant of a lot of these issues. And, you know, with many talks we've had, you've educated me. I have to say, I'm not surprised. I mean, look at what's happening in America. The bailout of the banks, come on. I mean, we all know that the deregulation under the Bush administration has led to this global economic meltdown, basically centered on greed. And greed is the reason why people don't own up to their responsibilities. All right? You do something wrong, a decent human being will make amends. But unfortunately, with governments who are more interested in serving corporations and the bottom line, often decency, humanity, compassion are lost in the run for the buck and holding on, the few holding on to most and denying the many what they deserve a fair share of.
And Rick, you've had experiences similar to the ones I've had when it comes to actually experiencing what I call Vietnamese forgiveness and compassion. And although you were not here in a combat capacity, you have seen this. Could you explain to our listening audiences your experience regarding Vietnamese compassion and forgiveness?
Well, like I mentioned before, you know, I've always felt very welcome. And always people will comment that, okay, we're friends now. America, Vietnamese, we're friends. You know, it's like there's no grudge that's being held. But I know that there's a lot of people in America still haven't gotten over 9/11, yet I don't remember ever seeing in any of the mainstream media what are the real reasons why these terrorists would even be drawn to do something that drastic. I think it was a horrible thing that happened. But I think that Americans don't look deeply at the reasons why things occur. And in Vietnam, the Vietnamese people are just happy after 1,000 years of struggle. More than 800 years against the Chinese, over 100 years with the French, and about 30 years with the Americans, they're finally happy to be free and at peace. And I think it's just in the nature of the people to not hold a grudge and to get over things. But whatever, as an American, I'm surprised by how well received I have been in this country.
Well said, Rick, and I would like to reiterate your point is that if Americans actually studied the history of Vietnam, we would understand that the Vietnamese are our friends. And actually, how many Americans know that Ho Chi Minh actually worked with the OSS during the Second World War? The OSS was the forerunner of the CIA, and Ho Chi Minh assisted in picking up shot down American pilots and rescuing them from the Japanese. And all of a sudden, overnight, and I think it was because of corporate interest, Ho Chi Minh went from a hero serving with American forces to a villain. And it's very, very unfortunate because Americans must realize that Vietnamese are our friends. There is a serious threat in this region, but it's not here. All you got to do is look on the map and look north. And there you have it, Cindy, yet another example of some of us displaced Americans finding a home in, of all places, Vietnam. And as Rick has so ably pointed out, this is a very friendly place. This is a beautiful place. This is a safe place, one that I feel more at home at, unfortunately, than back in the United States. And Rick, I am sure, speaks for thousands of expats who are here. I first began working with Rick in 2009, and he continues to work here in Vietnam. I think it's a testimony to the working conditions and people here and atmosphere that exists. And this concludes my special report with Rick Peltier, another displaced Californian. This is Jim Rhodes signing off from beautiful downtown Hanoi. this city for peace, the capital of Vietnam for over 1,000 years. Truly an excellent place, as Rick has pointed out, for foreigners to experience. Good day, Cindy, and thanks for this opportunity. Toi Io Vietnam.
That was our special soapbox correspondent in Vietnam, James Rowe. Now we'll hear from our special correspondent, Lisa Barr, as she's doing a piece for the October actions in Washington, D.C. So listen to special soapbox correspondent Lisa Barr and her guest.
You knew the earth was dying if they said this on the news. If they would clarify the picture instead of seeking to confuse. If you could see the ice caps melting, if you could watch the oceans rise, if you could see the consequences right before your eyes. If you knew the kids were dying, if you could look inside the river where their food comes from, filled with cyanide. If you could hear the parents pleading, if they were looking right at you, if you could see the anguish in their hearts, what if you knew?
This is Margaret Flowers. The more you learn, deeper you get. And during the health reform process, trying to get single payer policy just talked about, you know, really pointed out kind of all the deficiencies in our political process here and how it's not about data. It's about special interests. It's about front groups for, you know, Democratic Party and for the industries that profit off of our current situation. And, you know, what we ended up with was not health reform and not meeting our needs. And to me, that's just unacceptable in a country where we could provide high quality, universal, comprehensive health care to every person. So I started questioning myself as to what is it really going to take then to get change. And we need greater numbers to be able to overcome this corporate stranglehold on our political process, on our corporate media. And so it seemed like it was pretty interesting that so many other advocacy groups and people who are advocates were coming to the same type of conclusion on their issues as well, is that we need to join together in solidarity in order to really even get anything of substance, passed or changed in this country.
As Dr. Flowers spoke with me, people were knocking on the office door. You'll hear it several times. She was hard at work with fellow activist and attorney Kevin Zeese.
I think most Americans now look at the system as broken, and it is the system that's broken. You look at the electoral system. It's more of a mirage than a real choice. There's definitely, corporate domination of who gets the money to run, who gets on TV to be seen, who gets into the debates. And so Americans basically get to choose between two corporate approved candidates. And the same with lobbying. Lobbying, there's no room for people's voices. They don't want to hear what the people's voices are. I look at all the issues I work on. I work on a wide range of issues, economic, healthcare, anti-war, torture. And I look at all these issues. The answers are right in front of us on all these issues. We have the solutions. And they're not going to be put in place because the status quo that profits from the current mess controls it. They control the political process. And so we need to stop the machine and create a new world. And the challenge is ending the twin powers of corporatism and militarism. And that's what we're focused on.
Also in on the conference call, writer, producer, media consultant, and fellow organizer Dennis Traynor.
It's absolutely insane that we are now debating, or Congress is now debating, what of the social safety net programs we should be cutting, and military spending is not on the table. This coalition is the October 2011 coalition, stands for what a majority of the American people want. The representative democracy, as Kevin has said, is completely broken. You're not doing your duty by going to the ballot box. You have to, in some way, engage with direct, creative action like the October 2011 movement is doing.
Traynor was working on bringing in relevant comedians for the October 6th event, including Jamie Kilstein and Negin Farsad.
Barack Obama is sending 40,000 more troops to Afghanistan. That is the opposite of none. That is the opposite of ending the war. That is George Bush, Genghis Khan, my dick is bigger than yours, bull.
it. But what's really scary about getting your, you know, yourself tested and STD tests in general, they're just so scary, right? And so I actually decided to tell my mom about it, right? And it's already hard enough to say to your mom, look, lady, I fucked a bunch of dudes and I might be diseased. But to say that in Farsi.
We want to come out of this with two things, Lisa. We want people to come out trained and ready to resist in coordinated ways across the country. At various times, the focus will be on banks, other times insurance industry, military installations. We'll see as the opportunities arise to do civil resistance. But the bigger task is also to find a way so people can not cooperate with the system. And what I mean by that is we need to develop an alternative to the crony capitalist economy. And that we're starting to develop a more participatory, democratized economy. We can see the seedlings of it starting to sprout on things like employee-owned businesses, cooperative businesses, where consumers or the employees own it, with participatory budgeting, which we're seeing in Chicago now and also in beginning in New York, where people actually have decision-making power over how the money is spent, local money is spent on infrastructure development. There's a whole range of things. If you go to It's Our Economy and look up Democratize the Economy, you can see a whole series of sessions that we organized at a democracy convention recently held in Madison that's to produce a framework for a new economy. So we have to develop a new economy alongside this corrupt one, a participatory democratic economy. We want people to come out of Freedom Plaza with both tools to stop the machine on an ongoing way and build a new world in an ongoing way. And when we have, and you know, when you build those two legs, then I think we'll be able to stand up and really make some serious change. Again, it's not a short-term solution, but it's not a short-term problem. We are going to make change. We're going to make a better world if we stand together. But people need to sign up at October2011.org and get involved, because without your involvement, you know, we can't succeed. We can succeed if you get involved. This is basically the 1% of the wealthiest Americans versus the 99%. We have, you know, 400 people in this country who have as much money as and much wealth as 154 million of us. That is unacceptable. Those 400 people are only paying 17% in annual tax rate on the federal taxes. The, you know, someone who earns $50,000 a year is paying 25%. That's unacceptable. We need to have the 99% of us stand up against the 1%. We can do that. We got to do it in a way that's strategic and coordinated and effective.
They're filling the prisons. Their leanest industry, which lines their pockets, helps us all be free. Because you got to do something with the unemployed if they won't move to Shanghai. And it's the best democracy money can buy.
A bit of David Rovick's Best Democracy Money Can Buy there, reminiscent of a quote Flowers and Zeese like. It's a variation of the old saying that progressives must vote for the lesser of two evils. The quote is, Obama is the more effective evil, and the author, Glenn Ford.
He's one of the editors of Black Agenda Report, which is a really excellent publication. Some of the editors of that have known Obama since before he was a politician, and they've seen him evolve from his signature gathering days into what he is today, and they're not surprised at the level of the sellout. And I don't think they're disappointed with Obama, because they saw it before he got to office. This is where he was going, and in fact, almost everything he's doing, he said he was going to do. So if you weren't blinded by his brilliant rhetoric and his great communication skills and his lovely smile and lovely family, I think you would have seen that this was what was coming. You know, compassionate conservative George Bush fooled a lot of people too. And hope and change Clinton fooled a lot of people too. But all these people have been, you know, corporate militarists. That's what they are. And that's the system we have to challenge. And you could put anyone in that system right now, and it's not going to be all, he or she's not going to be able to solve the problem. We have a rotten system. It is corrupt deeply. And that's something we have to face up to and deal with. And it's not going to be something that's dealt with quickly. We have to recognize that Freedom Plaza is a very, very important step, but it's only a step toward a long-term effort to undo decades of misdirection.
You can see what will be discussed at Freedom Plaza by Google searching October 2011 Human Needs, Not Corporate Greed for their 15 discussion points. These are ending corporate rights and notions that money equals speech, ending wars and militarism, supporting human rights that end exploitation of all peoples, guaranteeing worker rights and jobs, real transparency for government and accountability to international law, barrier-free elections, the end of private for-profit prisons and the start of evidence-based drug laws, universal health care, education as a right through university or vocational training, safe, affordable housing rights for all, environmental policies that create a non-carbon-based energy economy, the end of policies fostering the huge wealth divide for finance and the economy, the creation of systems protecting the land and water to create a sustainable food network, and affordable, clean, convenient public transit system for all, including safe spaces for pedestrian non-automobile travel.
What actually ties all the 15 core issues together is kind of what Kevin said earlier, is that for every crisis that we face in this country, there are proven solutions, evidence-based solutions to them. And in many cases, the supermajority of the public already supports these positions, these solutions. And on each one of them, the government is going in the absolute wrong direction. So, you know, if you look at healthcare, solidly across the board, 65% of Americans for decades have supported a national improved Medicare for all. If you look at Democrats, 80% or more of Democrats support that position. So what did the Democratic Party do? They hired groups and brought institutions together to push for a public option and tell people that they should, you know, take the public option because that was the best choice, and that we couldn't get single payer and this was a backdoor to single payer, and all of that was complete misinformation. And then they tossed the public option out the door, and these front groups still supported the legislation. So, it's all a mirage in terms of what's happening at the government level, and it's why we think that the people can do a better job of making decisions about the issues that affect their lives than the politicians at this point, who really represent the power elite, the wealthy, both themselves individually and the industries that they work with.
But this is something that's been growing for decades. You can go back to 1971, the Powell memo. If you don't know what that is, you can go to itsoureconomy.us and look up Powell memo. It's a memo written by Justice Powell 2 months before he was nominated to the Supreme Court. He wrote to the Chamber of Commerce and put out a plan for the corporate takeover of all the key institutions in our society, from universities and journals and think tanks, up to courts and government. And they've done a great job of taking over, and we've got to undo that mess now. So it's a big task. It's not an easy task.
Has this sort of thing worked before elsewhere?
Well, we were inspired by the Arab uprising in Egypt, and it certainly worked to get rid of Mubarak. It hasn't resolved all their issues. They're still looking for more change. The problem is nothing has worked. And we have to do this. We don't see this as a one-time action. We say it's a beginning. We make that clear in the pledge. This is a beginning. We need to build an independent movement, an independent media, and then out of that will come independent politics. And when we develop those kinds of things, then we can have an impact.
And you have to get people to come. Is this event going to be fun?
No question it's going to be fun. We already have a dance night planned. Everything we do is going to be fun. I mean, when you're doing work that's positive like this, it's going to be fun. And we definitely agree that you got to dance with the revolution.
There's all types of opportunities for people in the plaza to have fun, get involved. There'll be different events going on in different areas of the plaza, different kind of spoken word events or story tents. You got the main stage. But the fun thing is coming together with like-minded people, not sitting alone and isolated and alienated, but coming together with like-minded people to actually create solutions together.
If people look back at history, they can see, you know, what that one person can make a tremendous difference. There is a lot of power we have that we have been told we don't have. You can look at Cindy Sheehan sleeping in the ditch outside of George Bush's ranch and reigniting the anti-war movement. You can look at the refusal to sit on the in the black back of the bus. I mean, you can look at sitting at a lunch counter. You know, there's three examples: sitting on a bus, sitting at a lunch counter, and sleeping outside. Pretty simple acts. And look at the power they created. So I think people need to have some self-confidence and recognize that they are a much more powerful force in the world than they realize, and have some self-respect for that, and know that they deserve more. And second, I think people also need to come together and realize that at the group consciousness, that together we can run the country better than the political and economic elites. History really is unwritten. We don't know where it's going to go from here. And what we're trying to do with this is trying to change the course of history and put it onto an arc that really shifts the power to the people. And you'll want to be able to tell your children, your grandchildren, that you were there for this, that you were part of the beginning of this. And so history is knocking, and I urge people to answer.
Any ideas on that, Dennis?
It's a statistical certainty that empires will end, right? So the scary thing for me, and sometimes this comes off as hyperbolic, but the scary thing for me is, how do you bring down an empire smoothly in the post-nuclear era? Right now, I don't see our government and the military-industrial complex letting someone else up on the hill. We're playing like a game of King of the Hill, and we have to figure out a way gently to bring this thing down in a safe landing.
Thanks to Dennis Traynor, who gets the last edited word.
It starts here, and it is defined. Anyone can define what it is. But for years, there have been a lot of people involved on the far left trying to send a message, trying to send the right message, trying to stand for the right things. And that is very noble. But in addition to that, now, we are starting something new. We are presenting solutions, coming together to find solutions for the problems that have been plaguing us for so long. So if you want to be part of the beginning, if you want to be in on the ground floor, plastics.
Thanks also to Margaret Flowers and Kevin Zeese of October 2011. They will be at Washington, D.C.'s Freedom Plaza October 6th, along with, among others, David Rovix. This is his Tunisia off the newly released Big Red Sessions. For Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox, I'm Lisa Barr.
Muhammad had a vegetable stand. This was his family's plight. Ever since his father died on a construction site. He was one of six siblings. Now this would be his fate. Working the streets of the city to put food on everybody's plate. Couldn't afford the bribes. Cops wouldn't make him pay. So sometimes they'd knock his cart over, get him back that way. Last December they smashed his scales, put him in his place. Then for good measure, cops spat Muhammad's face. Went to see the governor, maybe there was something he could do. Word came from on high, we don't talk to people like you. Muhammad Bouazizi, now was living on a wire. Went and bought some paint thinner, and he set himself on fire. Word spread through the region, soon you'd hear it same. Proud and desperate people, going up in flame. Sometimes windows open, sometimes the floor it creaks. But no one knew what would happen in only a few weeks. When the dictator ran away, just what happens to a dream deferred. The police kept up the attack, thousands wounded, hundreds killed. With blood the streets were covered, with gas the air was filled. But the people held their ground, Tunisia's daughters and their sons. put down their guns when the dictator ran away.
We can only keep this radio show on the air with your support. The Soapbox is not sponsored by corporate dollars or owned by any station, which means we need your contributions to keep Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox alive. Being on the air is a chance to break through with an alternative, progressive viewpoint, going out to many listeners, people that can be affected and inspired to create change. Join the list of Soapbox supporters. Visit CindySheehanSoapbox.com. And click on the donate link there, or send a check or money order to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox, Post Office Box 6264, Vacaville, California, 95696. Please make a contribution today of any amount to ensure that the Soapbox is here to stay. Help keep Cindy on the air.
That was Special Soapbox Correspondent Lisa Barr. I'd like to thank you for listening today, and I'd also like to thank my Soapbox team, Scott Cuddy, my engineer, Mikey, my producer, Rich Bowser, my webmaster, Dee Dee Miller, who's new on the Soapbox team, who's doing the transcripts to put on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox Blogspot. And I'd like to especially thank the listeners for supporting the show. We need all the support you can give. If you can afford to send us some money, mostly Cindy Sheehan Soapbox is a labor of love, but we also have bills to pay. I'm Cindy Sheehan, and you've been listening to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. We'll talk to you next week.
I must make my witness.
have to tell you things are bad? Everybody knows things are bad. It's a depression. Everybody's out of work or scared of losing their job. Dollar buys a nickel's worth. Banks are going bust. Shopkeepers keep a gun under the counter. Punks are running wild in the street. There's nobody anywhere who seems to know what to do, and there's no end to it. We know the air is unfit to breathe, and our food is unfit to eat. We sit watching our TVs while some local newscaster tells us that today we had 15 homicides and 63 violent crimes. As if that's the way it's supposed to be. We know things are bad, worse than bad. They're crazy. It's like everything everywhere is going crazy, so we don't go out anymore. We sit in the house, and slowly the world we're living in is getting smaller, and all we say is, please, at least leave us alone in our living rooms. Let me have my toaster and my TV and my steel-belted radios, and I won't say anything. Just leave us alone. Just leave us alone. Well, I'm not going to leave you alone. I want you to get mad. I don't want you to protest. I don't want you to riot. I don't want you to write to your congressman because I wouldn't know what to tell you to write. I don't know what to do about the depression and the inflation and the Russians and the crime in the street. All I know is that first, you've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value. Chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore! Just get up from your chairs right now. Go stick your head out and yell and keep yelling, I'm as mad as hell, I'm not going to take this anymore! Just get up from your chairs.
They're yelling in Baton Rouge.